From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We are joined in studio today by the Naples-based author Nathan Hill. To say his 2016 novel called The Knicks was well-received would be an understatement. It was described as one of, if not the, best new work of fiction of the year by many reviewers and publications. The great American novelist John Irving described Hill as, quote, the best new writer of fiction in America. The epic 700-plus page work that spans five decades explores family dysfunction, political unrest, and the ways technologies have taken over our lives. Today, we'll explore the decade-long process of writing such an expansive novel and the ways sudden literary success might change a person's life. We'll also hear what's on the horizon for the Knicks and for Nathan Hill's writing career. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A new novel called The Knicks came out in the summer of 2016. It was the first book by a man named Nathan Hill. A lot of first novels are published every year, but rarely does one come along that garners such sweeping and universal praise as The Knicks has. Its voice, its scope, its themes, and its characters all come together to create such a cohesive whole, you pretty much have to read it to believe it. Nathan Hill lives in Naples, and he's going to be the next author featured in the Sidney and Byrne Davis Famous Author Lecture Series next Monday, January 8th. So we thought we'd bring him into the studio to pick his brain about writing The Knicks, what all went into the research behind it, and find out what effect its overwhelming success has had so far on his life and career. Nathan Hill, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, can I start with an obvious fangirl question?
Sure.
What did it feel like when you saw that Stephen King had tweeted about your novel? He said, quote, I'm reading The Knicks by Nathan Hill. Just started, but so far it's got me laughing hysterically. First 50 pages are worth the price, end quote.
Yeah, that was on a day where I was just minding my own business, and then I looked at my phone and I had, you know, several dozen Twitter updates, and I'm not that active on Twitter, so this was really surprising. I was like, something has happened, so I checked. That was amazing. That was in a point where the book had just came out, and Stephen King tweeted about it. I got a very nice email from Judy Blume, who invited me to Key West to speak at her bookstore there. And I got an email from John Grisham saying, great job, loving the book. And I wrote him back, and I'm like, either this is really a pleasant surprise or one of my friends is punking me really, really effectively.
I mean, you know, yeah, so I got this email from John Grisham.
yeah. It's a hard thing to get used to. I would show my wife, and we would just kind of gawk at the screen.
What? That just happened?
Yeah.
So by the time that you saw that tweet from him, you already knew that your book was getting some good reception. I mean, John Irving compared you to Charles Dickens, for goodness sake.
Yeah, that was the first story about the book that really came out in a widespread way was that story where John Irving, who was a hero of mine, like I read all his stuff when I was coming of age, and to have him say such nice things. In the New York Times, of all places, I remember getting that email from my publicist saying, you have to look at this story. I was on a road trip with my wife. We were in upstate Florida. We had found this like brewery on the water. We were looking out at the sunset. There were dolphins jumping on the water. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
It was like that idyllic. I'm like, I feel like I've and then that story came out. I felt like I was in a computer simulation and had escaped my own reality completely.
That has to be surreal.
It was. Surreal. It was very, very, very strange. It was the beginning of a very odd year.
But the dolphins almost push it into cheesy.
I know. I told her at the time, there's no way I could write this scene because nobody would ever believe it.
I know. Yeah. I'm not putting this in the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So what authors influenced you? I mean, who are your favorites?
Well, Irving obviously is one of them. I discovered him when I was a young man, maybe thinking about becoming a writer. I had just moved to Iowa City to go to college at the University of Iowa. Turns out they have a good writing program there that I didn't know about. I was an engineering major at first.
But lucky for you, you were able to change and not change schools.
Yeah, no kidding. And so I started reading John Irving then because you know, he was an Iowa City guy for a very long time, and he wrote novels, several of which were about young men who were becoming writers. It just felt very proximate. So he was one of my first really big influences. And then after that, I don't know, the way I think of it is, you know how certain music or certain bands or certain songs hit you at the right time in your life to really penetrate? That's what it's like for me. So I read John Irving at the right time in my life. The next writer that really influenced me was probably Virginia Woolf, whom I read in college and then in grad school, and I just loved the way her character, the tone of her novels is like listening to a character's brain voice from the inside. You know, it's like being some. I tend to think that fiction is the best invention we have to try to feel what it's like to be somebody else, to not be in our own head for a while. And Virginia Woolf, for me, does that just about as well as anybody. So Irving and Woolf and then David Foster Wallace. I started reading after he passed away. I hadn't read him until he passed away, and I read his last novel first and was just blown away by it, and went back and read everything else. So I liked his courage. I liked his playfulness. I tend to think that the Knicks is hopefully, if I'm doing my job right, a sort of distillation of my favorite things from those authors.
So now your book can kind of hit people at the right time too, because it kind of embarks with this political situation. Can you give me like a quick summary of that, and how timely was that, and how much did you pull from reality on that?
Yeah, the book opens with this absurd crime that happens and then goes viral very quickly, which is that there's a far right presidential candidate who one day is like walking through Grant Park in Chicago, you know, glad handing and baby kissing and so forth. And then from out of nowhere, a woman starts throwing rocks at him and hits him. And somebody happens to be there to record the whole thing. So that gets online and goes viral. And the news kind of does what cable news tends to do, which is, you know, blows it up way, way, way out of proportion, that kind of flying avalanche of coverage on this thing. And everybody comes to their own conclusions about why this woman, who it turns out was a kind of former protester in Chicago in the 60s, and why this woman is throwing rocks at this presidential candidate. And then the job of the book then is to upend all of those assumptions. All those turn out to be wrong, but you don't know why until you finish the book. I can't say that very much of it came from reality.
But weirdly, reality followed.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote that character. The politician is named Governor Packer, and I wrote that character probably 8 years before the book came out. And I was just writing him to be absurd, to be funny. He really kind of crosses the line into, you know, what you would think is acceptable in political discourse. And then the book came out just before our presidential election, and everybody was saying, oh, you based this on the current election season, didn't
yeah.
you? I was like, no, I honestly didn't. I was just trying to write something that would be absurd and funny. But reality caught up with me really, really quickly.
Isn't that scary?
Yeah, it is. It is.
it's amazing. And then you talk about how the news cycle does what it does. And as Stephen King was saying, it's hilarious and I'm laughing out loud and I'm only 50 pages in. It was really funny, yet it is very much reality-based. I mean, as far as the way that the news spins things go viral and everybody tries to fill in their own blanks.
Yeah. Some people have said that it's sarcastic, that it's kind of a black comedy, at least in places. I don't tend to think that necessarily. I'm not necessarily sarcastic. I just describe things as they are. But sometimes if you just take a look at something really, really closely and take it out of context a little bit and put it in a different context, you can see how ridiculous it is. So we're kind of used to and maybe inured by what cable news does to the story of the day. But if you make one up and then just have cable news do what it does and like really follow it for, you know, 15 pages, you start to understand that it's just absurd, that it's just ridiculous. And so that's really what I'm trying to do is not necessarily poke fun at anything, but just describe things as they are in a way that maybe we can see it slightly differently.
Yeah, instead of as a consumer, but as more of an observer.
Yeah,
I mean, when you're observing it from a certain perspective, from any perspective.
Yeah, that's
and then
right.
Describing
and you
it.
have to kind of detach a little bit in order to be able to do that. When I'm watching news as a consumer, I'm aware that the news is trying to get me angry, trying to get me to feel emotions, you know. And because if it does that, then I will tune in, I will click, I will what have you, I will engage. And so in order to subvert that kind of emotional attachment, sometimes we need fiction to be able to do that. You know, we need a fake story so that we can see it clearly, so that we don't have that knee-jerk emotional reaction when we read about, I don't know, some politician we dislike very strongly.
Well, it's kind of like you're describing Virginia Woolf and how fiction is such a great way to understand reality from a perspective of fiction.
Yeah, and I think of a Tim O'Brien quote when he's writing about capturing the truth of Vietnam, and he says sometimes a novel is more truthful than a nonfiction can be because you can get at how something feels. You're not bound by what actually happens.
Yeah, that whole pesky being correct. Can you try to summarize the whole of the book? I mean, we just talked a little bit about the beginning of it, and I don't want you to do any spoilers for us or anything. But in the billboard at the beginning of the show, we called it a 700-plus page work that spans five decades, explores family dysfunction, political unrest, and the ways that technologies have taken over our lives. Does that description kind of cover it, or how would you change or modify that?
Well, it is certainly all of those things, but when I describe it, I usually stick closer to the characters. Really, the book is about a mother and a son. The mother is Faye, and the son is Samuel. And Faye leaves the family suddenly and unexpectedly when Samuel is 11 years old. And he doesn't see her again for a little more than 20 years until one day she's on the news throwing rocks at this presidential candidate. And so he decides to investigate her. Not only to discover why she's committing this absurd crime, but also to try to figure out where she went all those years ago and what she's been doing and why. And that mystery kind of takes you through the book, and it takes you to 1968 in Iowa and the protests at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 68, the protests at the Republican National Convention in New York in 2004. It takes you to World War II era Norway and we come to understand that Faye has this epic story that nobody ever knew about, and Samuel certainly didn't. So it's really I kind of describe it as a family mystery. It's a son trying to put together the pieces of his mother's life.
And he's a writer.
He is a writer, yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of research and discovery as a writer is a little bit of what you were doing too in the process of putting this together. How long did it take you to write this book?
It took 10 years. I started writing in 2004 what I thought was going to be hilariously a short story.
and 700 pages.
Yeah,
later.
Right, exactly. I realized pretty quickly that the short story had legs to it, and then it had characters that I wanted to pursue in a bigger way. But yeah, it started in 2004, and I finished a first draft 9 years later. I took one more year to revise that draft because the first draft was 1,002 pages long, so I ended up cutting about 300 pages. Mm-hmm. In that year, and then showed it to my agent. So it was 10 years in the making, and then my agent sent it out to publishers, and it was sold within a week, which was
wow.
Unbelievable.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that after being sort of ignored by the publishing industry for more than a decade. I didn't have high hopes, but Knopf bought it, and I found a perfect editor for it. So it was all, you know, it was just really good luck.
That's great. And full disclosure, Nathan is on the very tail end of a cold. So I do really appreciate you powering through this.
Yeah.
I can tell.
Just like everybody else, I think, in Florida, I caught something over the holiday travel. But,
exactly.
Yeah, I'll muscle through it.
But I apologize for making you talk so much. But it's so great to get to talk with you. So when you came to this book, you said you were going to make it a short story. Did you have a narrative arc already kind of set up in your mind, or were you able to just kind of wander where you wanted to go?
I didn't have a narrative arc set up. When I do that, I discovered, and when I did try to do that with this novel, I discovered that that it was kind of boring. Not only the story was boring and predictable probably for a reader, but it wasn't incredibly exciting for me to write either. I discovered that I like to write in a more improvisational way. Mm-hmm. And so when I sit down in the morning to write my scene, I know the setting, I know the characters, but I don't know quite what's going to happen nor where they're going.
Oh, so you let them lead you.
Yes. And so really what I'm trying to do is I try to write a good sentence, a sentence that is not only kind of rhythmically interesting but also is true for what the characters are going through. And then I try to follow that with a good sentence, and then follow that with a good sentence. And if I can string those several good sentences together, a plot sort of shows up. E.L. Doctorow has this great line about writing, and he says that writing a novel can sometimes feel like traveling across the country at night, that you can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. And that's what writing this book felt like. I couldn't see very far in front of me, but I just kind of kept going and going and going.
That is such a great analogy. I really love that. So, I mean, it took you a while to write it. So did you have to go back and tweak things as far as pop culture, updating things or changes?
Sure, absolutely. I started writing the book during the second Bush administration. And a lot of that material felt completely antique, just 4 years later. And so the book became less, I guess I'd say, less political because of that. It became less about who's right or wrong in politics. It became less sanctimonious, frankly, and became much more about its characters, about not necessarily who's correct in politics, but what it feels like to live through a moment of political change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very grateful for that. I think it's good that the book took that long to write, because I think it would have been, a little too too committed to current news, current events, and it wouldn't age very well. So I'm very happy that I wrote it over the time that I did, because I think it still speaks to a political moment, even though we've moved on, obviously.
Yeah, just given the last few years, nothing would age, you know. So, if you're just joining the show, we're talking with Nathan Hill. His 2016 novel, The Knicks, took the literary world by storm. He'll be at the Sydney and Burne Davis Arts Center in downtown Fort Myers on Monday, January 8th, for their famous author lecture series. Have you read The Knicks? Now's your time to talk with the author. Join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So when did you come to know Norse mythology would become a central theme in The Knicks?
Yeah. When you describe the book to people who haven't read it, it sometimes sounds like a complete patchwork of or a collage of all these random things. Yeah, Norse mythology, that's in there too. Old folktales from Norway. Ghost stories specifically. I really love those old Norwegian ghost stories where the ghosts are not necessarily scary. They're more like tricksters. You know, they're much more like into punishing you if you try to take too much credit for something you shouldn't be taking credit for. Those stories were with me because my family on my mother's side came from Norway a few generations back. They became farmers in Iowa, and most of my mom's family still lives in Iowa, and in eastern Iowa, close to the Mississippi River. I remember reading these stories kind of along the way, and because I knew that they were part of my family history, they would stick. And one day I was writing, and I just realized there's this ghost story that would make a really wonderful metaphor, about a rock that that contains the spirit of a drowned sailor. You find it on the beach and it looks like a normal rock. But according to the legend, if you take the rock onto the water with you, if you take it on your boat, the farther you get from shore, the heavier and heavier and heavier it gets until it drowns your boat. And I thought that was a really wonderful way to capture what a certain character was going through as he got farther and farther and farther away from a certain decision he made. He just felt heavier and heavier and heavier. And once I did that, I was like, well, shoot, might as well put in lots
more.
Go all
the way.
Yeah, and so several different ghosts make an appearance.
So I carried this book with me on a trip to see family over the past week, and there's something that you just mentioned, which is that the stone. Samuel's mother, Faye, she talks about that stone and says it gets heavier the further you get from home, and one day it drags you down beneath the ocean. She called it a drowning stone, right? That's what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever noticed that sometimes a book can kind of do that to you? Like once you get yourself invested in it, you're very conscious of the weight and the size and don't lose your page. And you feel like you don't. I mean, some books, yeah, whatever. But when you really get into a book, and that's what this book did with me. Of course, I got the hardback, so I would know how heavy it was.
Yeah, I'm glad. I thought you were just talking about the sheer weight of the book. It is very thick. I'm sorry about that.
No. But I mean, I didn't mind. It wasn't I didn't feel like I was drowning because, first of all, I'm not Faye, so I don't have those issues, particular issues.
Yeah, thank you. That's I do know that feeling, and that feeling of like when I'm really into a book, and especially one that I've lived with for a very long time, I find myself racing towards the ending, but also feeling this melancholy that it's about to be over and I can't have it anymore.
I think a lot of people are having that feeling with this book too.
Thank you.
I mean, how does that make you feel as an author knowing that people are doing it? I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of people are having the same, going through this journey, and it's kind of an intimate thing to put a book out there.
It is, especially in, as you know, the last chapter, I really kind of wear my heart on my sleeve. I figure if the reader has been with me for 600 and some pages, they'll let me get away with some kind of very emotional material at the end. And so, yeah, it is. It does kind of strip you down a little bit. But the really nice thing is that the readers who who are affected by it are so gracious and so wonderful. I've met them on tour. I've been touring for about a year and a half for the book. They contact me on Twitter or on Facebook, and it's just super. It's such a delight, especially given that I honestly did not think that anybody would ever read the book. You know, it's a 600-page book by somebody that by an author that nobody's ever heard of. You know, so I didn't have great expectations, but yeah, this has been just delightful.
So, well, now they have. So your new theme song is "How Do You Like Me Now," right? Can you explain what a Nyx actually is, though? That's one of these ghosts.
Sure. Yeah, a Nyx is one of those Norwegian ghosts. It has a couple different names. The Nyx. Nyx, it's spelled N-I-X. That's actually the Germanic spelling of the name. In Norway, it's known as a nokken, or it's also called like a nixie or a neck. I used Nyx because I like just the wordplay in English. Mm-hmm. But the ghost is a spirit of the water, and it's a shapeshifter. It's usually depicted as a kind of ugly troll when it's in its true form under the water. But it will appear to children as a white horse, a beautiful white horse, and it will tempt them to climb aboard. And if they do, it'll run them into the water and drown them. And the moral of the story being I think probably like don't trust things that are too good to be true, you know, like you. But in my telling of it, I was thinking about it from the child's point of view, that all of a sudden here you have your own horse, like your very own horse. It must have been the greatest thing that ever happened. And then tragedy strikes. And the moral to me seemed to be that sometimes the things that you want the most or love the most in life can also hurt you the worst. And I realized that that was something that was happening to all of my characters. They're undermined by the very things that give their lives the most meaning. And so that became a convenient organizing metaphor for the book.
It really did. And then the main character being a college professor named Samuel. I want to call him main, but there are a lot of characters that really come to the fore. But it begins being told from his perspective. Is there a particular person that he is based off of? Is that based on you or an amalgam of people?
Well, it's lovely to be here today because I taught at FGCU. I was a writing teacher at FGCU for something like 9 years, I think. I would come to class and park in the very same parking lot I parked today to come here. And so I think Samuel is sort of based on who I was my first couple of years of teaching. And I kind of came to class thinking that I was going to present this material and the students would automatically just be enthusiastic and enjoy it. And they would suddenly love poetry, even though I wasn't like doing very much to try to stoke that love. And I would just get really frustrated when that didn't happen. And it didn't. It took a couple years of teaching for me to realize that it was sort of my responsibility to lead them through this material in a way that would ignite some kind of emotion from them. And so that kind of, I don't know, banging my head against the wall feeling that I had my first couple years of teaching, just because I was a new teacher and I just needed to learn how to do it. I gave that to Samuel. But it's a much more pronounced and kind of global feeling for him. He's a very crusty teacher. He's very sour about his profession. I like teaching. I've done it for a long time, and I get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. But Samuel, he seems to resent his students. But further than that, he seems to need to resent his students. If he resents his students enough, then that kind of hatred feels good in that way. That like if you find yourself an enemy and then hate them, it kind of, I don't know, gives you a purpose.
I feel like it was his own self-loathing turned outward.
Yes,
you know,
that's exactly
so
right.
He was mad at himself that he wasn't a successful writer that he wanted to be.
That he took it out as on his students. That's exactly right.
If you turn that anger outward on other people and don't like them, it feels a lot more empowering, like you say.
Exactly, exactly. And that feeling, you can kind of mistake that feeling for reality if you allow it to kind of inhabit you for a very long time, which of course Samuel has done.
Yeah. So you're writing about this guy and he's writing a book and his publisher says that he hopes it becomes the next big thing. Did you ever think that what you were writing would turn out to be the next big thing?
Oh, no. My wife was really enthusiastic about getting it out there into the publishing world. I remember telling her that, you know, the average first time author can expect maybe, you know, a print run of about 5,000 copies and then you get to work on your second book, and that was going to be just fine by me. That's what I expected, because I have, you know, a lot of friends who are writers and a lot of friends who have published amazing books, and not every book finds its audience right away. Yeah. And so I was really aware of that. And so the fact that this book has done what it's done was a great shock, a good one, but a great shock.
Well, about halfway through, Samuel, who's the English professor we're talking about, he says, you know, I'd always wanted to be a famous writer. I thought being a famous writer would help me solve certain problems. And then suddenly I was a famous writer and the problems weren't solved at all. When you wrote those words, did you at all suspect that your book would achieve what it's done? And then how has that impacted any problems that you thought may have needed to be solved?
Well, I don't think I was specifically thinking about my own this book in particular. I was thinking much more about my desire since I was young to be successful, you know, to lead a sort of writerly life. For a long time, you know, I thought, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to move to New York City. I'm going to do the whole thing, you know, go to the Paris Review parties and rub elbows with, you know, famous people. And I did move to New York City and I did try to do that for a while. And it just wasn't me. And what I realized somewhere along the way was that a lot of what I thought about becoming a writer had to do with what people back home would think of me if I did it. You know, they'd think, oh, look at him. He's gone on and done this great thing. And that's a kind of BS reason to, you know, to organize your life. You know, that's a terrible way to live. And I guess that's what I was thinking about when I wrote those lines, that that sometimes we do things not because we legitimately want them, but because we think that the people in our lives want them for us, and we mistake that for our own desire. And so that's kind of Samuel's problem, I think, and mine too for a time.
Yeah, I think everybody has that.
Yeah, I do too.
As much as you might want to stuff it down too, it's kind of always a constant little nag somewhere in the back of your brain to think about what others are thinking of what you're doing. Or I sometimes think of what my younger self would think of what I'm doing now, you know, back in time. And that's usually going back to old places where you used to live or whatever. So another part, when I was reading this book, I took a moment in between to walk away. And then when I came back to read the parts about Samuel's mother and her take on music from the orchestra when she was sitting outside of the school, I thought, okay, this kind of sounds like someone else that I read about recently. Who was that? And then I had to do the whole mental gymnastics to get back to the beginning of the book. And I was like, oh, Bethany and her feeling for music. And there's that similarity there. Bethany's the girl that Samuel loves. Was that similarity intentional?
Yeah, the book has a lot of what I might call twins or echoes. I mean, there is literally a pair of twins, Bethany and Bishop. Bethany being the girl that Samuel falls in love with, and Bishop is her brash twin brother. But there are also a lot of echoes through time, you know. So Bethany and Faye are both musicians to a certain degree, and of course we have two different eras of protest in 2004 and 1968. And you know, one of the sections is called Circle, another section is called Revolution. So hopefully I'm not hitting it too hard on the nose that history is repeating itself over and over. And you know, Faye's abandoning of her family is echoed by her own father in a mystery that she solves along the way. So things kind of come back again and again. And so in the writing of it, yeah, when I realized that that Faye maybe played some music, it was a very easy thing to do, to kind of go back and kind of create those ligatures between those two characters, mm-hmm. so that there's this echo in the reader's mind.
Well, and sometimes there are echoes in people's relationships too, like Samuel's relationship with his mother and then echoed with Bethany with the music. How did you learn so much about music to be able to write that? I mean, how do you?
Well, the reason I moved to Naples, excuse me, the reason I moved to Naples was because of a girl, a woman that I was dating at the time, and I moved down here when I got the job at FGCU, and she plays for the Naples Philharmonic, and we're married now, so it was a good move, and so. She's my consultant for all things music. She's the bassoonist for the Naples Philharmonic, and so my violin playing friends would help me, because Bethany is a violinist, and she would help me, you know, just kind of describing music, and nothing would reach final draft regarding music without her stamp of approval.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's always good to have an expert in the back pocket. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll have more of our conversation with Nathan Hill. He's the author of the best-selling novel, The Knicks. Give us a call at 877-428-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We're joined in studio for the hour today by bestselling novelist Nathan Hill. His 2016 book, The Knicks, took the literary world by storm, garnering rave reviews from publications around the world. Publication rights have been sold in at least 16 different countries. And there's even a movie in the works, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But I want to get back to the story itself and the novel itself. And we talked earlier a little bit about The Drowning Stone, which is the thing that gets heavier as you get further away from your home. And eventually it drowns you. And I was talking about carrying the book along with me. Well, one of the main answers to that would be getting an ebook, right? Just put it on your iPad. So that brings us into technology. I mean, this novel really nimbly shifts from small town Iowa in 1968 to a world saturated in technology. Tell me a little bit about the technology that you're writing about.
Yeah, I wanted to jump around a lot, not only in terms of my subjects, but also in terms of how I approached them. Each section in the book has a slightly different feel to it. You know, some sections are madcap and comic, and some sections are much more nostalgic and emotional. Along the way, I realized that I was writing a long book, and so I wanted to give people a different kind of experience as they navigated their way through it. I think of the advice that Sondheim gave Lin-Manuel Miranda about writing Hamilton, which was variety, 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 you know.
So that gives us the iFeel app and then the multiplayer video game.
Yeah, so I thought it would be really great in a book that was also about protest and in the 60s and so forth to also like come be very contemporary and talk about some like social media and video games. So I invented a couple technologies. One is a social media app called iFeel where people can broadcast their emotions to their followers at any given moment. And another one is called World of Elfscape, which is a total ripoff of an actual video game that I played called World of Warcraft.
Oh, okay.
If you don't know that game, it's a massively multiplayer game. It's sort of high fantasy with elves and orcs and dragons and so forth. And you play it with other people, and often thousands of people are playing it at the same time. And so I have one character, a college student named Laura, who is obsessed with iFeel, her social media app. And another character, you never learn his real name. You only know his avatar's name, Ponage, and he's obsessed with World of Elfscape, as is Samuel, and that's how they meet. They're in the same guild.
I know, but usually people don't meet face-to-face, so that was an awkward first meeting. Although,
yeah.
It seemed more awkward for Samuel than for Ponage.
Well, you never meet IRL in real life. And so when Samuel faces a moment where he's utterly alone and he just needs somebody, he turns to his elf Escape friends, and one of them, Ponage, agrees to meet IRL, and that's how he comes into the book.
Well, Ponage seemed to kind of really need to make a connection with some human being besides nachos. And P.S., I had to get nachos for a week after that. I was on a nacho quest after a reading, even though it was kind of gross how Ponage went after those.
Yeah, there's a very lengthy description of how he inhales a plate of nachos.
His justification for eating really bad, cheap food is because he's saving up money to eventually go on a diet and eat healthy food, which is more expensive.
Yeah, and then later in the book, he decides to go buy the healthy food at the organic grocery store and realizes he's completely out of his depth, that he's completely intimidated by going into like a Whole Foods type store and he has no idea what to buy or the vocabulary that's used.
Just the parking lot there can be intimidating for some.
Yeah,
no kidding.
No kidding.
So he says toward the end, just because something doesn't happen doesn't mean it's not real, to describe his memories of playing a video game, which might seem kind of cringy to folks who don't play video games, but it kind of occurred to me that that same thing happens when you read a great novel.
That's true. Or when you look at a work of art, you know, he makes the point that his character, you know, climbed a mountain in the Elfscape digital world and watched the moon rise over the horizon, and he found it beautiful, and he wonders what's different about that than people who go to a museum and look at a painting and find it beautiful. Just because it's digital and in a video game doesn't make the beauty any less real.
So you played World of Warcraft. I mean, did you get involved in it to where you just couldn't get away?
I played it. I wouldn't say I was a compulsive addict or anything, but I played it quite a lot. I mean, there was a time in my life, this was probably between 2004 and 2007, where I played it pretty religiously, and I was quite good. Like I was in one of the top rating guilds, and we were conquering the highest level content in the game. And in order to do that, you have to really make it like a part-time job. Like it really requires a lot of time. And at the time, that was what I needed. I was having a really rough time in New York City, which is where I was living at the time. I had been robbed recently. The writing wasn't going very well. I was not enjoying New York City in the way that I kind of always thought I would. I was working for a nonprofit poetry organization, so you can imagine what my salary was.
Oh, I bet it was huge. Yeah.
So things weren't going very well. But at the end of the day, I could come and fire up this game and be good at it and play it with other people who were also good at it, and we all valued each other because of that. And so it felt like community. It felt like like almost a support system for me at a time that I needed it. So eventually I did quit because it was just taking way too much time, and I kind of resented that. But I had this love-hate relationship with it. I hated how much time it was taking away from my real life, but I really loved it for what it did for me at a bleak moment. For me, so that love-hate relationship, that ambiguous relationship I gave to Pwnage, I thought it was interesting literary material because I was so conflicted about it.
Well, it's really current too, you know? It's interesting the way that it plays off of the emotional situation of Pwnage. And then you have this version of technology dealing with emotion. And then you have Laura's version of dealing with emotion through technology, which is with I Feel, putting those feelings all out there. But there's a lot of emotion, though, that the other characters are all trying to suppress, too.
Well, the thing about
poor Samuel with the crying.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, the thing about social media is that it's easy to forget that the version that you put out on an Instagram or on Facebook or on Twitter or what have you, is not the whole you and all your multitudes. You know, it's a curated version of you. But it's very, very easy to think that is you, you know, and to start living as if that's reality.
I mean, if you are the perfect Instagram photo,
yeah.
Or as if you are the dragon slayer in Elf World?
Elfscape,
sorry.
and so with I Feel, what I was trying to get at, I mean, I kind of literalized that where you're allowed to broadcast what emotion you're feeling, but only if it's one of the pre-approved like 50 standard emotion choices.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally it is confining you to a box. Like you can only feel one of these 50 things. And Laura has a kind of crisis halfway through the book when she's feeling an emotion that is not one of the 50 pre-approved emotions. And so she's doubting the emotion that she's feeling.
Is this even real?
Is this even real? And so it sort of reminded me of, you know, of the, you know, when people get all of their news on Facebook, for example, their version of reality is a little warped, you know, and because of the algorithms at work. And so you're kind of confining yourself. And so I wanted to do that with I Feel, to show how one can be confined, how one can put oneself in a box and not even know it if you spend too much time with these media.
Which is – it's funny too, because when you go to the throwback to 1968, that box was the confinement of a small town overlooking the Mississippi in Iowa for Faye.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And she has always known that what gets her approval is, you know, being a good student, you know, listening to her elders and the people in authority, and just doing well in school. And then suddenly she does so well in school that she gets a scholarship to leave, to go to Chicago, to go to college. And suddenly the town turns on her, you know, in a kind of like, oh, you think you're better than us now kind of way, which is really shocking to her. That the thing that she'd done all along that got her approval suddenly did exactly the opposite. It's her version of a Nyx, that the thing that she valued the most suddenly undid her.
Oh, yeah. So tell me about your familiarity with Eastern Iowa towns. I was reading that, and I've been in that area, and I lived in Western Illinois, just across the river, for a long time. And while I was reading those descriptions, I was thinking to myself, this is a person who has definitely lived there, because the description of the smell of the stacks along the river, and it reminds me of Keokuk, Iowa, which is further south, I think, than where you're from.
Yeah, my family is from Clinton, Iowa, and Comanche, Iowa, which is not that far from Keokuk, and yeah, there's a a corn processing plant on the Mississippi in Clinton, Iowa. That was the inspiration for that particular factory.
It smells like potato buds. You know those instant mashed potatoes that come in a box?
It does, or like burnt potato buds. Like there's a kind of sulfuric smell to it. And it's one of those smells like in Florida when you turn on the heater for the first time in a year. You know that kind of like almost blow dryer that's been on too long.
Yeah, I did that last night.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, this is the worst smell. And you sit there for 10 minutes like, is this thing done stinking
right.
yet?
Yeah, exactly. It smells like that. But yeah, so my family is from that area of the world, and I spent my first 6 or 7 years living there, and then my family moved away. We've kind of bounced all over the Midwest, a couple places in Iowa and in Chicago, St. Louis, Oklahoma, Kansas. But every summer I would go back to Iowa, to Eastern Iowa, and see the family. And so that was like the only real stable place in my life. And so when I was writing about home in the Knicks, it was pretty easy to pick that.
Yeah. And so did you have to go and find that salmon-colored house in Norway?
I made that up. When Faye goes to Norway, she goes to Hammerfest, which is the northernmost city in the world. And it's where my great-great-grandfather came from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's incredibly remote. And I have not been able to go there myself. I've been to Oslo, Norway, but not to Hammerfest. But you can, unbelievably, walk the entire town of Hammerfest on Google Street Maps. And so I have done
that. Is that great?
Yeah, it's great. So I did that in order to capture the feel of the town, hopefully accurately. But we'll see. I'm planning a trip to Hammerfest sometime soon. So.
That'd be great. That's totally my Elfscape, by the way. You can just get stuck on that, looking at the streets in any
absolutely.
Town.
Absolutely.
We are talking to Naples author Nathan Hill on today's show. His 2016 novel, The Knicks, is now out in paperback. He'll be at the Sidney and Byrne Davis Art Center in downtown Fort Myers on Monday, January 8th for their famous author lecture series. Have you read The Knicks? Now's your time to talk with the author. Join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So moving now to the act of writing the book, how is it working with an editor these days? What is the process that you go through?
I found an editor who was perfect for this book. His name is Tim O'Connell, and he's at Knopf, and he is about my same – we're the same age. I'm 42 now. He's, I believe, 40 or 41. And so we had the same references. He played the same video games on the Nintendo and Atari that I did when I was growing up. Oh, we have the same kind of references. So he got it. He understood the kind of pop culture-ness of the book. But he's also a very, very good, storyteller, and he's merciless with his cuts, you know? And so we together went through the book and cut out a lot of stuff. And he's a very good editor in that he doesn't say, cut this, this needs to go. Instead, he'll identify a problem. This is dragging, you know, this is this necessary?
Kind of make it your idea.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly.
So you're not as upset about cutting it.
Yeah, and then I'm the one who has to solve the problem. So he provides the service he provides is being an incredibly helpful reader, and then I just identifying problems, and then I get to solve them, and usually solving them means cutting some stuff out. But even more than that, I mean, the last edit we did on the book, we both went through the entire book literally page by page with the goal of cutting one sentence per page. Because if we could do that, then the book's going to be another 20 pages shorter and just that much more tight. And
do they try to kind of place limits on page number?
They don't. I know that
they being the big quote they publishing people.
I know that my publisher would have preferred to have it not eclipse 600 pages. I think in the 500 still seems reasonable, but once you get above 600, it starts to seem absurd. So they wanted to do things like reduce the size of the typography to get it under 600 pages, but it just looked like a really uninviting wall of tiny text, and
yeah.
I didn't like that. So I wanted it to look approachable.
It would look like a religious tome if you did that. You know?
It's not supposed to, it's supposed to be a fun book to read. It's supposed to be a book that you can kind of fly through, and so I didn't want it to look intimidating.
Yeah, well, you do fly through it because you want to. I mean, because the characters are engaging.
Thank you.
So not that I'm just trying to lavish on the praise, but I mean, I'm just telling you, that is a point of fact. So where did the photo on the cover, which is an important photo throughout the book, where did that originally come from?
That I found that photo in one of my research sessions at the Chicago History Museum research library. I went there for years. I would spend afternoons at the library because they have this collection, like several boxes of just stuff from the convention week in 1968, photographs and old newspapers and handbills and underground newspapers and so forth. And you have to ask them to get it out of cold storage like 2 days ahead of time so it can come up to room temperature.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
And then you go through it with these white gloves. And so I was looking through. I obviously did not live through 1968, and so I had to do a lot of research to be able to get it under my fingers. And so one of the things I did was just look at every single piece of information in the research center, and I came across this photograph, and it showed people sitting in Grant Park at a protest, and there was just these three characters who just looked like the characters that I was currently kind of interested in, this certain love triangle. I just saw this woman leaning on the shoulder of this man, and behind them, this woman in aviator shades who just looks just bad, like, you know, and she's just very, very cool. And I'm like, oh my God, those are my characters. And so I asked them to print out a copy of that photograph, and I stuck it up on my wall in my writing office. And eventually, when I started describing my characters, I would just describe them according to this photograph. And then eventually the photograph made its way into the plot of the book. And when my book designer heard about that, he's like, I have to put that on the cover. So mm-hmm. that's what happened. I love it. It's very beautiful.
Well, you did use a word to describe one of your characters that is kind of interesting in its oddness, the word bigly. You used bigly to describe. Did you write that before the coin was phrased?
I got there first.
The phrase, yeah.
I got to bigly before it was more popular.
Really?
Yes.
Did you trademark bigly?
I wish I had.
That would have been a good one. That would have been great. I had never heard bigly before. That was used by Donald Trump.
Yeah, it was in my telling of it. I'm describing the way a certain guy sits. Like he's a big guy and he sits bigly, and you kind of see those man spreaders. I think is the term for it. Yeah, that's how I described it. And then when I heard Trump using it in the debates, I believe I just had to kind of privately laugh.
I'm like, hey,
yeah, that's my word.
Has he been reading your book? Toward the end, you use a metaphor of a single drop of water in a bucket being the lens through which the media creates stories that then define our worlds, although there are a lot more than one drop of water in a bucket. Can you reflect on that a little bit and the idea that we're defining ourselves via the media using the exceptions rather than the broader norms?
Yeah, I gave that line to Walter Cronkite in 1968, and Cronkite was my vehicle to talk about media storytelling, specifically television storytelling. And one of the things that happened in 1968 in Chicago is that Cronkite and Dan Rather and others for CBS News were there on the ground seeing what was happening as police were beating protesters, and they told it like they saw it. They said that the Chicago convention was about to start in a police state, that the Chicago PD, at least that night or those nights, were acting like a bunch of thugs. And the surprising thing for Cronkite, I read later, was that he would say this on the air, and then he would get phone calls, lots of phone calls from people thousands of miles away, saying he didn't know what he was talking about, that just disagreeing with him on the basic facts, even though they were watching from television. And what he realized was that the news in covering the sensationalized bits of the protest movement, made that the kind of way people thought of the reality of the protest movement. In other words, the most colorful characters, the most extreme characters, the most newsworthy characters also just became the stand-ins for everybody. And if you look at the photographs or the video of the protest in 68, most of the protesters are not, hippies, they're mostly like people in jackets and white shirts. They're just students. They're just people who have an opinion. But they're all colored through the lens of the most sensationalized among them, And so you had this moment in the protest where all of the protesters were just thought of as stinking hippies, and then all of the delegates and the cops and the politicians were thought of as fascists, and everybody was reduced to these unendearing stereotypes, and thus no communication was happening between these two poles. And And as we come to the 50th anniversary of that event, it feels very contemporary, you know.
It really is.
Yeah, it feels very like in our current state of like hyperpolarization, it sort of feels like we're living through this again.
Yeah. So do you think that is why there's a film apparently in the works?
Oh, it's a television miniseries.
Television miniseries.
That's right. Yeah. It's going to be a limited series, probably 9 episodes. And we are right now looking for a distributor. So hopefully we'll have some good news about that sometime soon.
And what's the word with Meryl Streep's involvement?
Yeah, she's producing and she wants to play Faye.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
I know. She's perfect.
Could you talk about fangirl.
You know what? Like I got that news not long after the book was published. I found out that she had been reading it and really enjoying it and wanted to do something with it. And then I got the phone call that she wanted to pair up with J.J. Abrams to make it. And that was one of the more exciting phone calls in my life, getting the word that she and J.J. were wanting to do the Knicks. So that's where we are.
Do you ever feel any pangs of fayness when people are saying, oh, wow, so Meryl Streep wants to play your role and these people are calling? Do you ever feel like, oh, geez, it's a little who are these people and how weird is it to be contacted by, you know, people, John Grisham saying, hey, great job. I mean,
it is. I'm certainly not used to it. I find myself sometimes I'll catch myself talking about it, you know, like, oh, we got word from JJ that da 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 da, and my wife will just be like, hold on,
hold please,
yeah,
let me
right,
process
yeah,
that.
Right, yeah, so it's all certainly very unusual. I will say that the Hollywood stuff has been just a delight so far. I went to LA about a month and a half ago to spend a week just doing story meetings with the writers and the producers and like hammering out the outline for the entire series, and it's just so much fun. I feel like I've learned a lot from J.J. Abrams, from the screenwriter who's taking on the most work. Our showrunner is named John Logan, who's a total pro, and he's been doing it forever. And I feel like I've learned a lot from them about storytelling, and I feel like, you know, I'm a better writer for it.
So it's really cool that you get to be involved too.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Instead of just handing over your baby and somebody can do whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's really a delight, and it's almost like I get to rewrite the Knicks. If it had been published 2 years later than it actually was published, what would I have done differently? And this is my opportunity. It's really cool.
Is Bigley staying in somehow?
I hope so.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today's show. But I want to thank my guest, Nathan Hill. He's the author of The Knicks, which is now out in paperback, which is lighter weight than the hardback. And it's also sold wherever you get your books. Nathan, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate you spending the whole hour talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a delight.
All right. Our show today was produced by Mike and Irie, Rachel Iacovone, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. It is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will.